The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of a book of meditations and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Woodrow Wilson, Democracy in World Relations. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, Woodrow Wilson applied the principles of Thomas Jefferson to the relations of the nations. Leading our country through the World War to victory, he dreamed a great dream of international justice and peace to be achieved by united collective action of all nations believing in the rule of law and not of force. For a time, the dream promised to be fulfilled. Its defeat, due to a combination of causes, of which our own failure to carry through in supporting it is not the least, has brought the world to the present tragic crisis, with a wide reversion to the rule of brute force, threatening the very existence of free institutions. Descended from Scotch and Scotch-Irish Covenanters and Presbyterians, Wilson was characterized from the beginning by tenaciously held moral convictions and by stubbornly fighting for them. Born at Staunton, Virginia in 1856, his boyhood was spent at Augusta, Georgia, the Civil War closing in his ninth year. His youth in Georgia and South Carolina brought him into contact with the miseries of the Reconstruction period. Educated at Southern schools and then Princeton University, with 2 years of law at the University of Virginia and teaching in Northern colleges, he early escaped any sectional view of American problems. With his instinctive democratic idealism, this prepared him to become the internationalist in dealing with world problems. Early he saw that every man must educate himself, and that education means developing intellectual activity and not merely acquiring information. These convictions guided him to the thoughtful reading that equipped him for his life work far more than did his school studies. He grew up wholly in the intellectual life, but with a deep-seated belief that education was not for the development of oneself, but for service of the state. From the start, he yearned to be not merely thinker and teacher, but man of action, able to make his ideas prevail. After a disappointing attempt at law practice, he turned to Johns Hopkins for 2 years' final training as scholar and teacher. The remarkable treatise on constitutional government, produced at 28, launched him as writer. He condemned committee government, believing in strong executive leadership with the widest democratic discussion and action. His happy marriage at 28 brought him the sympathetic and helpful companion, mother of his 3 daughters, who was taken from him as the World War broke. For the next quarter of a century, he was an educator, teaching at Bryn Mawr, Wesleyan, and then called to his own university, Princeton. He lectured widely, wrote valuable works on American government and history, literary essays, and a fine life of Washington. Toiling hard to achieve his effective style, he regarded it merely as a means. It was ideas he wished to make prevail. At 45, he became president of Princeton, and under his leadership, it was, for a time, the most progressive of all our universities. He saw that the abandonment of the old curriculum and the multiplication of new studies had destroyed unity of spirit, and that our colleges were training for divergent special ends instead of developing leadership for the state. He saw, too, that social exclusiveness, as fostered by the Princeton clubs, eliminated the democratic fellowship necessary to foster a unified intellectual life. He successfully established the system of preceptors with small discussion classes. His larger plan for educational democracy, while enthusiastically supported by the majority, was defeated by gifts to the camp of his enemies of vast sums of money. The trustees dared not refuse. Men were never indifferent to Wilson with his tenacious championship of ideas. They loved or hated him, and often the hate was as much a tribute as the love. This heavy burden of work was accomplished with frail health, which from his youth on had caused recurring breaks, which made it necessary for him to go away to recover. In 1910, he resigned the presidency of Princeton to become governor of New Jersey, elected by a large majority. During his term, he carried through reform measures, protecting elections, improving the position of labor, and controlling greedy, moneyed interests. in the Democratic Convention of 1912. Wilson was nominated for the presidency on the 46th ballot, the deciding factor being the speech of W.J. Brown. The split in the Republican Party, Theodore Roosevelt running against Taft, gave the election to Wilson. So began his leadership of the nation through the most crucial period of our history since the Civil War. Like Jefferson, Wilson was a personal executive, not easily delegating authority in his own field. In other fields, such as military affairs, he did delegate and firmly protected the independent action of his appointees. With a friendly Congress, he at once assumed forceful leadership. During his first year, he carried through such reform measures as the Underwood Tariff Law, the Federal Reserve Act, and antitrust laws eliminating injustice to labor. In all, he was liberal and constructive, not revolutionary. In his second year as president, the World War broke. Believing in the victory of ideas, hating all resort to brute force, the president urged upon our people a policy of strict neutrality. He even urged neutrality of thought as well as action, which is always impossible when moral issues are at stake. He practiced faithfully the neutrality he preached, holding the balance true between the warring nations. He protested alike British and German action, violating the freedom of the seas. Germany, believing her war machine invincible, continued her submarine attacks on merchant vessels, culminating with the sinking of the Lusitania in May 1915, when 100 Americans were drowned. A period of note-writing followed, the president still hoping to maintain neutrality in spite of exasperated public opinion. Amid these increasing burdens, Woodrow Wilson was blessed by finding a second dearly loved life companion in Edith Bowling Gault, whom he married in December 1915. She gave him a new deep of personal life, shared fully and with remarkable wisdom the fierce labor of the battling years, and became the center on which he tenderly rested, broken from the fight. With all his shy reserve, Wilson was an intense and devoted lover, with a certain boyish impetuousness continuing through the years. In her fascinating memoir just published, Mrs. Wilson not only tells with tender frankness the lovely story of their courtship, marriage, and life together, but from within the experience throws a flood of intimate light on one of the greatest chapters of American history. Wilson's second election was on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And within a month of his inauguration, he came before Congress to request a declaration that a state of war existed with Germany. This was due not only to the renewal of submarine attacks, but because he had come to see that all the ideals we held sacred were at stake in the war. The issue was whether free men were to be permitted to live their lives in peace and harmony with their neighbors, unmenaced by military machines driven by autocrats greedy of power. It was a conflict of ideals that went to its first battle on the plain of Marathon, its second at the Bay of Salamis, that has recurred repeatedly through the ages and is, alas, before the world again today. Having entered the war, the president threw himself wholeheartedly into conducting it effectively. But it was to be a war to end war. Already his mind was turning to the idea of a federation of nations to forestall lawless aggression and enforce peace. He disregarded party lines and appointments, striving to unite our whole people in the struggle to make democratic ideals prevail and to influence the peoples of the world rather than their governments. To this end, he stated in January 1918, the 14 points he held necessary to a lasting peace. Like the Declaration of Independence as drafted by Thomas Jefferson, the 14 points were a shining fabric of general truths, the only basis on which the warring nations could unite. Indeed, it was because Wilson adhered so faithfully to the principles of democracy of Jefferson and applied them so wisely to international relations that history will regard him as our outstanding American president since Lincoln. In November 1918 came the armistice, a war-torn world rejoicing at the cessation of hideous destruction. As was right, Wilson crossed the ocean to Versailles, where he could speak across the heads of the diplomats to the peoples of the world. His fight to secure a just peace with the establishment of a League of Nations to enforce it for the future is a Homeric epic. He had to oppose the most skillful diplomats who urged the conflicting interests of the several allied nations. He fought for a righteous peace that would not leave bitterness to cause a recurrence of the conflict. As always, the majority of common opinion supported him. To the people of suffering Europe, he was for a time the hero of the hour. He did not secure a reduction of penalties to the point he considered just, but did achieve the establishment by the treaty of the League of Nations with its noble and carefully thought-out covenant. His view was that as time went on and passions cooled, the League had all the machinery for correcting injustices in the treaty. War continues because the relations of the nations remain on the plane of frontier life, greedy aggressors jumping claims whenever they feel strong enough. The League, with 50 nations soon adhering to it, was not the final solution. That can come only through a federation of nations, establishing a legislative body to convert agreements into international law, a court to adjudicate it, and an international military, naval, and aviation police contributed by the associated nations to enforce the court judgments. We may hope for war to cease only when the relations of the nations approximate those of our states within the Union. While the League had all the elements for that solution, it was rather a first step, a vigilance committee to stop international claim jumping. Even so, it promised to be the greatest step man had taken since he began to make political institutions. It is justice that should be enforced, not peace. Enforced justice and peace follows. Peace among the nations, like happiness for the individual, is not an end, but a byproduct that comes when you live right. Worn near the breaking point, Wilson came home to find a group of Senate irreconcilables bitterly opposed to our entering the League and public opinion confused on it. The reservation demanded, he saw, would destroy the League's effectiveness. Ill as he was, he held it his duty to carry the fight to the people in whom he never lost faith. Against urgent counsel of physician and wife, he undertook that far western speaking trip in 1919. Everywhere he was enthusiastically acclaimed, but with incessant demands upon him. In Colorado, on the return journey, the blow fell, and the consecrated fighter went down as truly a martyr to his cause as had he been shot by an assassin's bullet. A stroke followed at Washington, but leaving his mind clear. Urged to accept any and all reservations, he steadfastly refused. Even his wife begged, "For my sake, won't you accept these reservations and get this awful thing settled?" He answered, "Little girl, don't you desert me. That I cannot stand. Can't you see that I have no moral right to accept any change in a paper I have signed without giving to every other signatory, even the Germans, the right to do the same thing? It is not I that will not accept. It is the nation's honor that is at stake." So we stayed out. And there followed Manchuria, Ethiopia, and the rape of Czechoslovakia, with mankind again facing the arbitrament of brute force. Had he not suffered the tragic break, there was every promise Wilson would win the fight. As at Princeton, he carried victory far and met final defeat, in both cases because selfish interests stifled the altruism to which he appealed and because he could not compromise convictions he held sacred. He recovered somewhat enough to dream of getting well and resuming the fight, but it was not to be. On the eve of Armistice Day, 1923, he gave his one radio address to the American people. Carter Glass, with a delegation, came next day to thank him. He replied on the porch of his house in his last public utterance, "I am not one of those that have the least anxiety about the triumph of the principles I have stood for. That we shall prevail is as sure as that God reigns." In that faith he died, February 3rd, 1924. At this dark hour of human destiny, may we have the courage to rise to his faith and carry on.
Woodrow Wilson, Democracy in World Relations, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Kipling, interpreter of the British Empire. Copies of tonight's discussion of Woodrow Wilson may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This is Radio Open House Week, and here is a thought. More than half of all radios in the world are owned by U.S. listeners. That's American radio. This is the National Broadcasting Company.